This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is Nikos Mikhailidis, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Hello, Nikos, and thanks so much for joining us.
David, thank you very much for inviting me and for hosting this discussion, and my greetings to all our listeners.
Thank you. You're welcome. We are speaking on Tuesday, July 7th, a few days after London-based research group Forensics Architecture concluded that it was, quote, highly probable that Mohammed Al-Arab, a 22-year-old from Aleppo, Syria, was shot by Greek soldiers in March as he joined thousands of migrants seeking to enter Greece after Turkey followed through on President Erdogan's threat to, quote, open the gates for refugees to Europe. Athens has rejected accusations that it used live fire, that its soldiers used live fire at the border. And many analysts have accused Turkey of weaponizing refugees to pressure Europe into providing greater funding for the 3.5 million Syrian refugees already in Turkey or to come to Turkey's aid in Syria's Idlib province, where some 2 million displaced people are living in ad hoc camps along Turkey's border. But Greece and the European Union are now facing calls to investigate this death of Al-Arab. Nikos, I saw yesterday you tweeted a very succinct response to the conclusions of this Forensics Architecture research outfit that Greece was behind the killing. BS, you wrote. I wonder, what did you mean by that? Are you saying that Greek soldiers did not kill him, or that more broadly Greece is not to blame for his death?
I would argue that we need to do further and more succinct investigation in order to be able to reach these kinds of conclusions, because as we know from the past, Greece, the police forces of and the security forces of Greece have been very sensitive currently and in the past when it comes to these kinds of issues. I don't know if you remember, but a few years ago, there was an accidental shooting of a young kid in Athens by a policeman who ended up in jail, of course. And then there was a mass protest in the country. So the political culture of Greece and of its security forces, I would say that would not allow these kinds of things to happen. That's why I'm extremely skeptical when it comes to these kinds of conclusions that have been reached by foreign investigators and sources, the credibility of which, I mean, we need to be very, very skeptical about that. Having said that, I think that the problem with the refugees and with the illegal migration has to be resolved in different ways. Greece has been hosting thousands of people and has been trying to do its best, even though we are a country that has financially collapsed in the last 10, 12 years due to the financial crisis. And also, I have to remind you and to our audiences that Greece has not actually participated in the destruction that has been taking place in Syria and in other places of the world. So one of the arguments that many citizens are making, and I have to tell you that citizens have been becoming more and more angry, and there is an agreement among different political parties across the political spectrum in the country that Greece has to protect its borders and its sovereignty. On the other hand, we want to help these human beings, our fellow global citizens, but we need to find solutions that will be for their benefit as well, but also solutions that won't create any kinds of problems for Greece, especially right now, a country that is struggling to put in place its own finances. So I would say that one solution would be to organize a kind of international conference about this situation, and, you know, make a decision through the United Nations in collaboration with the European Union that we should create particular collection centers in the Turkish territory so that people who want to apply for asylum, we can do this in a more organized and orderly way. that will help both the asylum seekers, but also the countries that are trying to fix this situation. And another thing with which citizens and many commentators in Greece are extremely angry with some international bodies, research bodies, and media is that the criticism is being focused on Greece, a country that does not bear any serious responsibility for what has been going on in Syria. We have to remember that Turkey has invaded Syria. Turkey has been invading Iraq, and through all these invasions, it has been creating refugees. So for its own geopolitical interests and reasons, Turkey invades all these foreign lands, and then is blackmailing the European Union, and Greece in particular, which is a small country, in order to actually legitimize and help them achieve their own geopolitical interests. And this is not going to happen ever.
Okay. Well, so about these clashes that happened along the border back in late February and March, I wonder what you personally thought of the Greek response, using water cannons and rubber bullets, charging and shooting at refugee boats in the Aegean. And then more recently, there have been reports suggesting Greece is pushing refugee boats back toward Turkey. Let's set aside Turkey's offenses, which are substantial. But put those to the side for a second. As a Greek and an EU citizen, what do you think of Greece being a crucial part of the EU's more militarized response to immigration, sort of being the EU's shield, as they put it, especially because, just as you said, Greece has a history of these kind of more friendly and open-minded police and security services, but that doesn't seem to be the case now. So I wonder what you think of it. What's your response to it?
Allow me to say the following first before I directly respond to this particular question, David. The problem is that it's not Greece that it has to decide by itself when it comes to the European Union, right? And we see, on the other hand, all the roads that the refugees and asylum seekers and migrants who are illegally migrating, coming to the country, want to follow in order to go to Northern Europe, because we all know that the majority of all these people want to go to Northern Europe, where they can find jobs, where they can find their relatives, right? Most of them want to go mainly to Germany, maybe Belgium and other countries, and Netherlands.
Sure, Scandinavia, maybe.
Exactly. So when you have all these countries that do not actually want to take all these people in, right, and then you have all these people that are being somehow trapped within Greece, within the Greek border. And the Greek government has been trying for years, has been trying to convince our European counterparts that we need to find a solution to this issue, we need to help these people, but Greece cannot do it in itself, because it's a problem which is much, much bigger and needs a kind of global solution. It needs the real serious involvement of the European Union. So unless the European Union decides that, you know, we are going to distribute this population evenly within our territories, because European Union is a big power, right? And Greece has been always saying that we need to help these people, but we need to do it a kind of equally and in collaboration. Greece does not have the power to resolve this issue in itself. So the outcome would be, if those people were allowed to get into the country from the Evros borderland, most probably the majority of them would remain trapped in Greece. And then the Greek society, the citizens of Greece, would have serious complaints about that. It would create more problems than it would have resolved. And this is something that we need to take under consideration. And we shouldn't turn these innocent victims, refugees or immigrants, into kinds of leverage in order to achieve various kinds of geopolitical interests, et cetera, et cetera. And Turkey has been clearly trying to do that. So the question,
but if I understand, yeah, sorry.
What else please. Can we do as Greece, as a country? I don't have a clear answer to that. On the one hand, I'm not feeling well for this unrest, for this situation. On the other hand, the majority of the Greek citizens support the government right now that the borders need to be protected, and we need to find a solution with Turkey and the European Union that will allow all these people to go to the different countries that they want to go. But this is not a decision that Greece can make in itself.
On Thursday, the European Parliament is set to examine Turkey's negative role in the Eastern Mediterranean and Libya, where Turkey has given military backing to the Tripoli-based Government of National Accord, or GNA. That support has increased in recent months, in part because Ankara signed a maritime borders deal with the GNA late last year that essentially erases the island of Crete, which is quite sizable, off the map. Ankara has announced plans to begin drilling off the Libyan coast and possibly in the area of Crete in the next few months. The Greek government has warned that any drilling in Greece's continental shelf areas will spark a heated response. All this is, of course, in addition to the potentially illegal exploratory drilling Turkey has already been doing for the past year or so off the coast of Cyprus. I wonder, what's the Greek view of all this? How might Athens best respond to all these Turkish aggressions in the Eastern Mediterranean?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question and a very hot topic right now in the country. Greece is really a peace-loving country, David. And you won't find in our political system even the most right-wing, I would say extreme right-wing. Now, we don't have an extreme right-wing party in our parliament right now. They lost in the last elections, and that's it. And this is a very good sign. That's extremely positive. I think we are among the few European countries who currently do not have an extreme right-wing party in the parliament, if I'm not mistaken. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But for a small country like Greece, who is facing various kinds of challenges, this is really important, and we need to stress that. Now, what Greece has been saying is that this is a completely illegal act that Turkey has been doing, and that Turkey has been bullying Greece and other neighboring countries. It has been bullying Cyprus. Turkey is still occupying Cyprus, and they don't want to actually negotiate a solution that will be based on international law, and that's also a huge problem. And another serious issue is that the Turkish military and political elites, they completely disregard that Greece is not just about the mainland, but we have thousands of islands. And this is something that they don't want to see, they don't want to accept. The Greek government does hope that they won't dare to go and continue the drilling off the coast of the island of Crete, because I'm afraid that this would create serious complications that might end up with a kind of military confrontation. And this is something that, you know, citizens do not actually want. Nobody wants war. Okay, as I said, we are a peace-loving society and country. Greece as a country does not have any kind of expansionist aspirations towards its neighbors. We are a pro-status quo country, but unfortunately, especially in the last few years, we see that this is not happening in Turkey, where the Ankara regime has been evolving into a kind of brutal expansionist and authoritative regime that does not only involve Greek and Cyprus, it also has to do with the situation of the Kurdish population in Turkey, in eastern Anatolia, in Kurdistan, but also in Syria and in Iraq. So I would suggest that when we want to think and understand the Greek-Turkish relations and the problems that exist, we should be able to view the whole picture of the whole Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East. Because according to the Turkish military analysts and political elites, they view this region as a kind of continuum from the Middle East up to the Aegean. What Turkey is trying to do is trying to gain geopolitical control of the Aegean Sea and of the Eastern Mediterranean. And of course, this does not abide by international law. Again, Turkey has not signed the international sea law, the agreement.
Law of the sea, right.
Yeah, exactly. And on the other hand, they are trying to create some kind of fake legitimacy and legality by signing these kinds of illegal agreements with a government, I put the word government in quotes, in Libya, whose authority has expired about 3 years ago, and it has not been renewed. So the idea that this is a recognized, the argument that this is a recognized government with which Turkey signed an agreement is highly problematic. So I'm pretty convinced from what we see in the different voices of the political spectrum, Greece is not going to accept those legal activities, and it's going to defend in any possible way and by any possible means its own integrity on the lands, but also on the waters.
Yeah, well, as I said, the European Parliament is discussing all of this on Thursday. I wonder what you think the EU should do about all this. On Monday, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu met with EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell and later said to reporters, quote, "If the EU further sanctions Turkey, we also have steps to take in the field in the Eastern Mediterranean," end quote. So it seems like sanctions, which I would guess are the most likely response, might only spur an escalating cycle of tit-for-tat aggressions.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what are the other alternatives right now, David. And I'm one of the few people in Greece who has been writing and supporting the democratization of Turkey. Of course, all the citizens, we want to have a democratic neighbor in our region with whom we can collaborate, work together. But this collaboration has to be based on international law. But I believe, as a specialist on Turkey and as an anthropologist who has been doing his research in Turkey, that in order to have a country that abides by international law, we need to have a democratic regime in Turkey. And this is not the case right now. And in order for Turkey to become democratic, there needs to be a solution to the Kurdish problem, a solution to the Alevi problem, and generally, I think, a solution to the human rights problem for all the citizens of this country. And I think that the European Union should support the real democratic forces of Turkey, like the Halkların Demokratik Partisi, the HDP, the leader of which is right now in prison, and thousands of activists. I don't think by keep negotiating with the regime will help Europe, the European Union, or the citizens of Turkey to achieve a balanced relationship that will also lead to the democratization of Turkey. Mm-hmm. I think that without a real serious democratization of this and expansionist regime, we will continue to face very, very serious problems. And I have to add something else. Greece is very sincere when it's talking about the democratization of Turkey. I'm not sure how sincere other European countries are. Maybe because they don't border with this regime. They don't care. Maybe because they have very strong business ties, like Germany, for example, right? But Greece has been really sincere in its willingness and criticism towards Turkey. And I think it's time for the Europeans, first of all, to apologize to the citizens of Turkey who have been struggling for decades to create a democratic regime in their country, no matter whether they are Alevis, Kurds, Turks, or any other kind of ethnicity. We need to support these people to change their country and make it abide by international law. That's the only way, and I don't think that these kinds of negotiations with the regime are going to achieve that. So, yes, I'm in favor of more sanctions, on the one hand, against the regime, not against all the citizens, of course, more sanctions against the regime. European Union has the power and has the means and the tools to achieve that very successfully. And on the other hand, I think that at the same time, we need to support all the democratic networks and activists who operate within Turkey or in European Union and elsewhere in order to help them bring about a change in their own country.
Okay. You mentioned your research, which is focused on traditional music in Turkey. I should first mention to our listeners that Pontic Greeks are an ethnically Greek people who lived in the region known as Pontus, which is today, roughly Turkey's eastern Black Sea coastal region, until just before World War I, when they faced death marches and ethnic cleansing, and then also after the war. And then those who remained were part of the population exchange between Turkey and Greece in 1923. I believe you are Pontic Greek. I wonder if you might share a bit of your family story with us and background.
Absolutely. And this is something that as a young scholar and researcher and as a citizen, this is something that creates a kind of contact with contemporary citizens of Turkey, especially those who live in the Black Sea region. My ancestry goes back to the Black Sea region. My father's side, my great grandfather came as a refugee to Greece in 1923. From the Greek villages of the region of Bafra, western Pontus, very close to Sinope. And from my mother's side, my ancestors came from Argyropolis or Gyumushane. And later in the 19th century, they migrated to Sivas, Sevastia. And from Sivas, they came to Greece. So I was brought up with all these stories and memories of the Black Sea region. And that's one of the reasons for which I got really connected with the heritage and the musical tradition of this region. That's why I'm also a lira or kemenze player, if you probably know. And so this also created inside me a willingness to get to know the contemporary inhabitants of this region and of this country, of course, right? Because we grew up with different stories about coexistence and even competition and violence. And I have to say that in recent years, we have developed a kind of political activism, a movement that is trying to gain recognition for the genocide of the Greeks of Pontus and of Asia Minor in general, because the issue of the genocide is something broader, and it does not only apply to the Armenian population. The issue of the genocide has to do with the Christians of Asia Minor at large, right? So we are talking about Armenians, Greeks of Pontus and Asia Minor, and Assyrians. So this is something that we are trying to put into the agenda. Many young scholars and activists have been writing and talking about this. And it's very good to see that we have many young scholars from Turkey who usually live abroad and who did their PhDs in foreign universities who have been supporting this demand, and they have been doing research and they have been writing about the phenomenon of genocide against Greeks in that region. So I have been traveling to these areas very often. I spent almost two and a half years doing my PhD research, my fieldwork research as an anthropologist in Trabzon and in Istanbul. And I have to add that after what we described, the so-called exchange of population between Greece and Turkey in 1923, a small segment of the Pontic Greek-speaking population remained in the area of Trabzon. And why did they remain in Trabzon? Because they were Sunni Muslims. So we know from Ottoman sources that a segment of the Greek population of Eastern Pontus converted to Islam, right? And even though they converted to Islam, they maintained their native language, which was a Greek dialect, Pontic Greek. And because the exchange of population in 1923 was based on religious criteria, not on ethnic or linguistic or whatever, so those who were Christians had to leave. And those who were Muslims, no matter what their background and their language, etc., they had to stay there. So what we currently see is a revival of ethnic Pontic Greek music, revival of this musical sound and of the lyrics.
Okay, so we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a minute. Sorry. So first, yeah, you say that you grew up in Saloniki, right?
Yes, exactly.
So it sounds almost confusing or disorienting to me to be growing up in this sunny place on the Aegean and be hearing all these stories about the Black Sea region, which is, you know, lush and rainy and mountainous.
Absolutely. Yep. But what is interesting here is, you know, all these refugee populations. I have been also studying the phenomenon of personal and collective memory, right? All the and we observe similar phenomena, David, among other refugees populations, right? Pontic Greeks are not the only ones who are going through this kind of experiences because they have a certain trauma for the lost, let's say, lost homeland, etc., etc., the memory of violent events. And these are not things that can be forgotten very, very easily. And these are things and experiences that took place almost 80 years ago. It's not that old. And there has been production of articles and books and films and narratives, etc., etc., that have been reproducing this memory. And as I said, we observe the same phenomenon in other refugee groups as well. So people like me, my generation, and even people who are younger than me, through music, through dance, through reading, they maintain a kind of imaginary connection with what used to be their great, great parents' homeland, Pontus or Black Sea or however we want to call it. So these groups are in a process of remaking their own sense of belonging and identity. They are Greeks. who live in mainland Greece, but they have their roots back in the Black Sea.
So you play this music, you've studied it, and you've actually been a part of the revival of Pontic Greek music in Trabzon and Black Sea region and beyond. And decades ago, this region was home to different ethnic groups whose music, you said, was in a way co-opted by the Turkish state. As we were discussing this interview over email, you told me that music in Turkey was long used as a political tool of assimilation and Turkification, but in the last 30 years or so, this has been collapsing, and ethnic identities have been reviving. Please, if you would, tell us a bit more about that, about this history of the early decades of the Turkish Republic and how it's all changing today.
So what actually happened with the establishment of the Turkish Republic in 1923, as you very well know, Mustafa Kemal, who was the leader back then and who was governing, autocratically governing the country, and all the elites who were with Mustafa Kemal, they were thinking that they need to find ways to create a sense of unity among the diverse ethnic and religious groups of Anatolia, the remaining groups. The Young Turks got rid of the Christians. There was the genocide, and those who survived were exchanged, in quotes. They left to Greece and to other parts of the world. So now they had to face a different problem. They had a majority of Sunni Muslim population, but they also had the Alevi population. But all these populations, and they have, and some Christian minorities in Istanbul and in Antakya, maybe in these areas. But mainly they had to face the challenge of how you homogenize and create a sense of Turkey's national pride and unity among populations that are linguistically very diverse. First of all, the Kurdish population. Even in the Black Sea region, you can find four different linguistic groups right now, if you go today. So there are the people who speak the Laz language, which bears some kind of similarity with Georgian, but it's a kind of different language in itself. We have a group that speaks Laz. We have a group that speaks Pontic Greek, which is a Greek dialect. We have a group that speaks Hemsin Armenian, right, in the Eastern Black Sea. We have a group that speaks Georgian. And we have, of course, another group that speaks Turkish, right? So actually five linguistic groups. So what happened in the beginning of the 20th century, Mustafa Kemal tried to, among other things he did, he tried to homogenize the population by using music. So he actually asked a number of musicologists to go out there in Asia Minor and collect songs with the aim of creating, of inventing a national Turkish folk music repertoire. And this is what he did exactly the way I described it. So they collected different melodies and then they gathered around a table. I'm oversimplifying now. Long story short, they gathered around a table and they started changing the lyrics of the songs. So they collected songs that were sung in Kurdish, in Arabic, in Greek, in Armenian, in Laz, in different languages of the people who were inhabiting the region, right? So now the challenge was to create new lyrics, and they did that. But by changing
in Turkish,
of course, but by changing the lyrics from the different language into Turkish, you're also changing the meaning of the song. So, for example, you might have one song which in its original version, in the original language, in Kurdish, for example, was speaking about love or separation. And now the new version in Turkish is talking about Turkish patriotism and how great the military is, for example. You understand what that means, right?
But it would keep the melody and the initial music, the original music.
I'll come to that too. Give me 1 second. I'll talk about the melody as well. So that's why, because of this policy, now we have very many common melodies between Pontic Greeks and the people who live in Karadeniz today. So we have the same melody that we sang it in Pontic Greek, but you can also find it in Turkish, Black Sea Turkish. There is the same melody that is sung in Kurdish and is also sung in Turkish. The same melody that is sung in Laz and in Turkish, in Georgian and Turkish, in Armenian and Turkish. So this is the outcome, this is the result of that policy developed by Mustafa Kemal and his regime. Now, what happened with the music, with the melodies? They maintained the same melodies, but the problem was that because different populations have been using different instruments, and different instruments sound in different ways, right, and create different feelings and understandings, they wanted to homogenize the sound as well. So they imposed, they said that every melody that is considered to be part of the Turkish folk music repertoire, especially those that are performed in the TRT, the State Television and Radio Broadcasting Company, they are going to mainly perform by using the saz, the baglama. So, because of that, the Pontic lira or the kemence had been completely marginalized, at least in the public sphere, right? It used to be quite rare to see kemence in the performances of TRT. Of course, this started to change a few decades later, but this is how it started. So they not only changed the lyrics, but they tried to homogenize and change the way that the melodies sound. And how do you do that? You impose one instrument in order to play all the different melodies from the different musical traditions of the different ethnic groups. It's like having an American government saying that, guys, you are not going to use your instruments. Now everybody's going to use a saxophone to play everything, right? something like that. And you are going to use specific lyrics to sing your songs. So this is what, more or less, long story short, this is what happened in Anatolia. But in the last 25, 30 years, we see that this has been changing because of the musical activism of different Kurdish musicians. And it is the Kurdish scholars, activists, and academics, and musicians who changed that. And they did something very simple. They started to sing their melodies in their native language, in Kurdish. And the guy who actually started this movement and now lives in Sweden in exile is Siwan Perver, the very famous Kurdish singer. And of course, many other groups and singers followed his own lead and path. But of course, many singers ended up in jail and imprisoned, etc., etc., for years, right? And this movement of...
This is during the, what, the 80s, the 90s, the
2000s? Exactly. Okay. Yes, yes. Okay. I would say late 70s, early 80s. Okay. I remember Kurdish friends telling me that they have been gathering in their houses secretly to listen to the cassettes of Siwan Perver, who was singing in Kurdish. And it was the first time that they were listening their melodies in their native language, recorded officially in a cassette that was, of course, illegally circulated among the community, right? Because I don't know if you are aware of that, it was illegal. It was not allowed by law. It was prohibited to publicly sing in Kurdish and in other indigenous languages.
Right. Sure, right. And
this is something that only late 90s changed somehow. Anyway, this movement of the revival of indigenous, as I call it, ethnic music of Anatolia, of Kurdistan, of Pontus, etc., etc., started with the Kurds, and then, of course, it split over, and now we observe a similar phenomenon in different ethnic groups. And what I actually did in my research was to study this phenomenon of this musical and linguistic revival by focusing on the Pontic Greek speakers of the area of Trabzon.
And so if we were to go to, say, Trabzon now, or Diyarbakir, or Kayseri, or I don't know, maybe even Istanbul, might we see this music being played live in public places in their original languages?
Yes, yes. In certain places, I wouldn't say that, with the exception of the Kurdish music, because Kurdish music has a very large audience, right? It has a very large base. But the problem with the other musical genres is that their audiences have been shrinking. And why? Because younger generations have not been able to learn their native languages, so they have difficulties understanding the original lyrics in Pontic Greek, in Lazian, Armenian, etc., etc. But there is an attempt by various scholars and activists to revive their language as well, because lyrics go hand in hand with language, of course. And another problem that these musical genres are facing is the problem of marketability, because it's not easy to find a recording company that would be willing to release your CD with songs in a language that not many people understand, and it's not going to sell a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So even though there used to be a few years ago some recording companies who played a very crucial role in the revival of different ethnic music genres, Right now, according to what many musician friends are telling me in Turkey, they are facing problems that have to do with the marketability of their music. So on the one hand, those musicians and the listeners, they had to face the challenges and the problems posed by the state authorities. And now, on the other hand, they have to face the challenges and the problems that they are facing because of the market inequalities, if I can describe it as such. But still, besides that, you can still find people in some places where they sing in their native languages, etc.
Well, still, even today, the Turkish state tends toward Turkish nationalism and thus tends to see the revival of ethnic cultures and identities as a threat. And it, of course, points to how the assertion of Kurdish identity, it would argue, led to a decades-long conflict in the Southeast. But in email, while we were discussing this interview, you argued that the assertion of ethnic identity and culture, such as Pontic Greek music, for example, can help both sides discover their commonalities, can build connections between young people, and perhaps even build bridges between states, which kind of, in a way, refers back to how this conversation started. But please tell us about all that.
So, yeah, absolutely. So, David, I think that what we are currently see happening in Turkey and all the invasions in Syria and Iraq and the problems with Cyprus and Greece, etc., I think that they have one common starting point. And the common starting point is the problem of national identity in Turkey and the problem of human rights, more broadly speaking, of the citizens. Because we know that Anatolia and has always been, and especially after 1923, when all the different populations from the Balkans were relocated to Anatolia after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the problem of the Ankara regime of Mustafa Kemal and the successive governments and regimes was how to create a unified Turkish national identity. And this project has not been completely successful, right? It had to go through different stages and through a lot of violence, violence that still continues. It is with us today. The fact that still we're talking about a Kurdish problem in Turkey today has to do with this problematic policy of homogenizing and Turkifying the whole population. This project did not work well, and many citizens reject that identity. On the other hand, you have the state that is trying to impose that identity, and here is the problem. So how do we resolve that? I think that, and when I talked about how citizens can play an important role, I think that the Turkish political elites and activists need to find a new kind of strategic plan and vision. And I think that the Democratic People's Party, the HDP, has this vision, actually. Unfortunately, the leader is imprisoned. And this new vision is this cultural and ethnic plurality, that the state has to accept the realities of Anatolia in Kurdistan, in the Black Sea, and in other regions of the country. And when they accept that reality, they will allow their citizens to express themselves, they will allow them to develop relationships with the outside world, right? And the Pontic Greek dimension is only one small portion of this broader network that can be created in order for citizens to come closer with each other. So I truly believe that if the regime allows the citizens to engage freely with their historical past, with their memory, with their identities, things will change very, very positively in Turkey, and this will have a positive impact in the whole region, I think. So I think that as citizens, as scholars, as musicians, we have the right to help people of Anatolia, the different ethnic groups, to come to terms with their own historical past, their own identity, and help them support those identities, right? And this is the way forward for us as citizens, but also as states, in order to coexist peacefully. And of course, the Turkish regime, the Ankara regime, has to overcome this expansionist ideology, Another problem that I think is very important.
Wait, before you go. To what extent do you think the Turkish government is enabling and encouraging these ethnic groups to express themselves? You mentioned that you can now find this music being played in these various cities. I mean, I understand the Turkish state is certainly not encouraging Kurds to express themselves.
Absolutely.
But what about these other ethnic groups? Are they being encouraged or at least allowed to express themselves more than they would have, say, a decade ago or two decades ago?
So that's the interesting thing. When Tayyip Erdogan came to power, these groups were not able to express themselves, their music, publicly. They were not allowed to sing publicly, right? They would end up in jail. They would have problems with the police, etc., etc. During the first years of the Erdogan government, things changed. And then people were encouraged, or I wouldn't say encouraged, they were allowed to sing their songs freely in their native languages. Now, in recent years, with this strange developments that took place after the so-called military coup attempt a few years ago, and the collaboration between Tayyip Erdogan and Devlet Bahçeli, the Nazi-like extremist right-wing party of this country, it seems that things are reverting back again, and they are trying to take back those rights that have been gained in previous years, the right of every citizen to sing his or her song in their native language. So they have been putting barriers, it seems, especially to the expression of Kurdish music and arts. But when it comes to other groups, maybe because they think that they are small groups and they wouldn't constitute a serious problem or something like that, I haven't heard of having any kind of prohibitions towards these other groups. But I don't know how things are going to evolve within the next few years. But still, they are in a kind of gray zone. And because there is this high nationalist fervor in the country, many musicians are reluctant to sing in their native languages because they think that they will be accused of being traitors or something like that. So even if there isn't any kind of legal obstacle right now, as far as I know, there is a kind of social and ideological obstacle that stigmatizes all these musician activists who are trying to promote their ethnic music. So this is a form of prohibition, and it's very serious.
And when will you be returning to Turkey again to continue your research?
I think it will take me a few more years. For now, I'm done with this current research, and I'm trying to turn my dissertation into a book where I'm also developing this idea about how music can enable citizens to come closer together, to talk about their past freely, right, and develop collaborative and friendly relationships. And so after that, I don't know what my next project is going to be, David, and I don't know if it's going to be about Turkey. I haven't decided yet. So I cannot give you a definite answer to that question.
Okay. Well, good luck with the book. It sounds very interesting. I'm looking forward to it. Nikos Mikhailidis of the University of Missouri, St. Louis, thanks so much for your time and insights. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
It was a great pleasure talking to you too, David. Thank you very much for hosting me.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.